Hey folks, Jeff here. This morning I'm sitting here with Michael Zimmerman, a dear integral friend and colleague who I've worked with for many years. And Michael is a professor at Colorado University here in Boulder in the philosophy department affiliated with the environmental studies department and is co-author with Sean Esbjorn Hargens of the book Integral Ecology. So welcome, Michael.
Thanks very much, Jeff. It's always fun to be with you.
This morning, I want to talk about a topic that is quite vexing to a lot of people, including me. And that is the topic of global warming, because clearly it's a huge issue. There are scientific consensus. There's a sort of a resistance to the scientific consensus. This is a classic integral case of worldviews talking past each other, and the stakes are high, and I get very confused by the whole thing, as do a lot of people. I'm also addicted to my lifestyle, and so I just want to say that I enter this topic with a lot of consternation, and I know you think a good bit about it. And so I just want to know where you're at, how you're seeing it, how you're unraveling it these days, making sense of it.
First of all, I totally agree. It's a vexing issue. And it's vexing for a number of reasons. One is that the status of the science is, in fact, still, vexing itself. But so are the implications of what science is telling us. Let's say many people involved in climate science say we have to dramatically decrease our carbon footprint, dramatically cut back on the use of fossil fuels, and therefore make significant lifestyle changes, which for a lot of people are not happy changes, not only in the developed world, but in the developing world, where there's still more than a billion people who have no electricity. And so anyone who's coming at this issue from a modernist perspective would say any dramatic cutback in fossil fuels will have a devastating effect, not only on developed economies, but even more so on people in third world countries trying to create for themselves a life that would be recognizable by us as something like a human life. Imagine life with no electricity, no access to power. For most of us, it's just totally unacceptable.
Yeah.
So how are we going to deliver power to those people with the types of energy that we have available? What we have available right now, coal, gas, nuclear, alternative fuels are alternative energy sources, solar and wind, just can't pull the load yet. So they're making a small contribution, but they're not anywhere near what's needed.
Yeah, I was seeing that in China and India alone, they're basically opening a new coal power plant a week between the two countries. And of course, emissions in the United States, and I think probably the developed world in general, but the United States for sure, are dropping. And our emissions are, I think, down to 2006 levels, which is due to better technology.
Well, it's mainly
probably the recession. I hear to some degree.
Part of it is that, but I think many people conclude the big factor is the switch to natural gas.
Yeah,
a lot of plants that once used coal are now switching to natural gas in an incredibly rapid change. Now, this is one from the point of view of the modernist economist. So the modern classical economists will say, look, the economic signals are there. Gas is cheaper, it's cleaner, so therefore it's going to create for you as an industry less flack from those who are concerned about CO2. There's a bunch of it. Much of it's found in the United States, so that security issues about gas, oil, for example, coming from the Middle East, those are taken care of. So the combination of factors has created a big rush to move toward natural gas, including fleets of trucks and so on are moving to natural gas production or natural gas for their.
And is natural gas the Marcellus Shale and that the new deposits of shale, or is that oil or both?
It's complicated. I don't fully understand it. This stuff up in Canada that would be that we would draw on to ship stuff down the pipeline. It's the Keystone, I believe it's called. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
That's coming from Canada, and I think that's heavy oil that's very energy
dirty.
Intensive to get it out of the ground. So a lot of people are puzzled about why are we doing that? Yeah, you're going to end up with a lot of oil, but it's so expensive and it's so CO2 heavy just in producing it, extracting it, that it seems like it's very problematic, but it's going to happen. Canadians are going to do that. Gas, I think, is also involves underground production with a process called fracking, but seems to have fewer environmental consequences than the production of oil in the way mm-hmm. they're doing in Canada. But it's not environmentally neutral. There are consequences. Many Greens are afraid that it's just going to leave a toxic nightmare behind. Many people involved in the industry say this is overstating the case. It's not going to have those consequences. We don't know yet. This is 40, 50 year kind of thing.
Yeah.
Here is the problem. In a democratic society like we supposedly have, although I tend to think it's more of an oligarchy run by the rich and interested, in such a society, you cannot get away with cutting back fossil fuel use to such an extent that the economy is seriously damaged. And that would happen.
Right.
There's just no way around it. We don't have the wherewithal in terms of alternative fuels yet to pick up the slack. She can't get away with it. So the issue is, what type of pollution are you willing to put up with? I mean, human beings create pollution.
Yeah.
Are we going to continue to burn coal? I don't like that. I think coal is the nastiest source of energy. Or are we going to go with this with natural gas, which produces less CO2?
I saw a very compelling article in The Atlantic by James Fallows, no conservative, mm-hmm. Very progressive guy who wrote about clean coal in China and was very positive about it.
Well, the people in the coal industry claim that they can do it. Well, I respect Fallows. He's a smart guy.
Well, see, this is the problem, Michael. And part of this is just basically found its way into the culture wars in general.
Right.
So we have modernist, and modernism is based on a growth economy.
Right.
And then we move into postmodern, which is based on a sustainability economy.
Right.
And those two are at war in general. And the global warming climate issue has just become the battlefield for this, right?
I think that's right.
Yeah.
And as a result, you have a increasingly politicized science. And this, I think, is very, very disturbing for the status of science in society.
Mm-hmm.
To the extent that science becomes increasingly viewed by the public, including modernists, as politicized, interested, in other words, in the outcome of their work, politically interested,
mm-hmm.
and who also have an economic interest in continuing to get government research grants to allow them to continue the type of climate research they're doing. This creates a lot of problems for science. Which I think is a very bad thing. And it's going, I think, to take a while to recover. Now, I think that's, and overall, science is still a respected institution, but the climate change issue, as you've pointed out, once it gets imbricated within the culture wars and scientists start choosing sides, that's really not healthy. Now, there's nothing wrong with scientists having a political point of view, but the challenge for a scientist is how to separate his or her political activity from the science in a way that prevents a bleeding over of politics into the science and scientists into the politics in a way that's not healthy. Roger Pielke Jr., who's a very well-known political environmental analyst at CU Boulder, where I teach, wrote a wonderful book several years ago called The Honest Broker. And he says, look, science should play the role of honest broker in these situations. And the way to play the role of an honest broker in a complex debate is to offer the policymakers, who are the ones who have to deal with value considerations, They have to take into account all the different values and consequences and so on. In a way, a scientist doesn't. A scientist is just dealing with trying to determine the facts of the matter. And that those are relatively value-free. I mean, that you shouldn't have too much value considerations in there. So how does an honest broker work? Well, his bottom line is this. A scientist should really be interested in offering policymakers a number of options. Instead of trying to narrow the options down to the one that the scientist prefers, offer a slate of options with your assessment of the consequences of each, or the viability of each, and let the policymakers work this out. It's not really up to scientists to make policy determination, because they're not equipped for that, nor do they have the, how shall I put it, responsibility that comes with making those decisions. Politicians make decisions. If they go wrong, they're thrown out of office. Mm-hmm. Scientists is tenured.
Yeah. You know, there's a part of science, like, for instance, and this is just basic good old Wikipedia, but since the early 20th century, surface temperatures have increased by 0.8 degrees Celsius, 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit. That's probably a fact that's unassailable. Now, where we get into problems is doing then predictions based on what might happen based on climate modeling, right, which is very complex. And I'm sure we're working our way in climate modeling to ever increasing accuracy. But in the meantime, it depends on what you feed into the computer as to what kind of a result you're going to get, right?
Or right. No, that's right. I think I would distinguish between complex and chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
Climate is a chaotic system. This means probably that in principle it cannot be predicted in the way we've understood. A complex system is something else. But a chaotic system is just possibly beyond our ability to understand, with maybe for years to come. I mean, that's one of the outcomes. Right now, we've had a pause in warming for about 15 years. All right. As far as I can see, and a scientist from England, a well-known climate scientist, said the other day that no one really predicted this. That this is not part of anybody's model. It shouldn't be happening. All right. Now we plateaued, and it's warmer.
Yeah.
We'll be plateaued at this warm point, even though CO2 production has gone up, it's continued to climb significantly. So why should that be? Why should that be happening? No one really knows. I mean, there are people trying to come up with hypotheses and so on to cover this, but it is an issue for climate scientists because it shows that they really didn't fully understand.
And this is now a big piece of the culture war,
right?
Because So we've had this plateau,
right,
for 15 years,
right,
of no surface warming.
No statistically significant.
Yes. While we've had a larger increase in CO2, right, than even expected. So I see then that the hypothesis is that the heat has been trapped in the deep ocean.
Right.
And so that's good. So I get that. And then I look at the other website and it says, wait a second, the deep ocean, we don't. You know, we have, I don't know what they were saying, we have enough thermometers that we can measure the deep ocean, one thermometer per a space the size of England. And these thermometers are floating around and it's not accurate. And so we can't, that's unknowable. And, you know, it's just back and forth like a badminton game.
Right.
And I don't know.
Well, I mean, I was reading up about that actually last night and this morning. I have a scientist friend, a biologist, an environmental biologist at Tulane, with whom I worked closely while I was there, co-directing environmental studies program. And he and I have been going back and forth about this. And it's really interesting because he's a green. And so, of course, the websites he examines for this are those which are pro-CO2, anthropogenic global warming. I don't think he really cruises these other websites, the contrarians, as they might be called. There's a fellow named Trenberth, a very well-known climate scientist, right here in Boulder. He works up at NCAR, which is the major climate research center in the United States. And he's been arguing that he agrees that there's been this pause, but he says there, his hypothesis is, as you were mentioning, is that this the heat, extra heat being generated as a result of the greenhouse effect by added CO2, it's there, but it's showing up in the deep oceans. That is below 700 meters. So how do we know that? How do we know that there's been a change? Well, their attempt has been made to, I believe it was Darwin, or around that time in the mid-19th century, that people started making some measurements in the deep ocean. Well, one can imagine how accurate those were. And that there's an effort to correlate contemporary measurements of the deep ocean, which, as you point out, are also debatable just in terms of their how accurate can they be, and to show what the increase is. Now, the increase is very slight. Is it big enough really to be a credible increase even? And there's huge debates about this. In fact, I was reading the other day, there's a well-known, another science policy expert, a guy like Roger Pilkey, who was writing about the hanging chads in the 2000 election.
In Florida.
Many listeners will recall that Al Gore and George W. Bush, it was down to a tie, basically. It was all about whether Florida was going to go which way. And it all came down to one county, and then it came down to a number of punch cards, basically, which had these little
ballots,
whether or not the little hole had been punched in the card. All right. Now, his argument was this. You could spend years and millions of dollars trying to determine what the fact of the matter was, and you would still have a debate. It's not something that can just be resolved by. And this is why I was very impressed by Al Gore. He did the right thing by conceding, not because he was necessarily defeated.
Right.
But because he knew that somebody had to give here, and he was willing to do that. I mean, I admire him for that a lot. And of course, elections have consequences. We see what happened with the Bush presidency. There was a lot of unhappy things that happened. But my point is this. In any complex situation like this, there's going to be almost endless debate. And as this the guy I was just talking about says, nature is complex, even chaotic enough, to offer a rich number of alternative explanations for a phenomenon.
Well, and I feel myself, even in this conversation, feeling a little nervous because where I live, and now you live here again, back in Boulder, you can't talk about there being a climate debate. The Green Thought Police will not allow that. And the idea is that the science is clear, we're going to hell, and hold on to your hat, and we're a cancer on the planet, and I don't know. You know this better than I do. Is there a scientific debate, and how's it lay out? And you know, are the deniers really funded by the oil companies? And I just get confused about
right.
this.
Right. First of all, I don't like the term denier. I talk about contrarians, people whose views are contrary to those who promote the idea that there's that human influence on the climate. Well, let me just say this first. Certainly humans are affecting the climate. I mean, we're a big, big, powerful species. CO2 is part of it. I mean, probably some of the temperature rise we've seen is attributable to it. The contrarians that I take seriously acknowledge that they're probably playing some role in that. But so are a number of other things. For example, land use changes. I mean, cutting down humongous amounts of forest and replace them with cropland. I mean, this changes the albedo. That is a reflective nature of the surface of the Earth, changes the way climate works. Also, the presence of aerosols, tiny particles in the atmosphere, some of which can be produced by volcanic explosions. I read recently, just the other day, there was a big volcanic outburst in Russia. And also there was, at the same time this spring in another country, which haven't made the headlines, but they could well have an effect on crops this fall if, as a result of cooling the climate, because they're going to block the sun a bit, just enough to have earlier frosts in the Midwest, for example. So that, but that's, we can't control volcanoes. So volcanoes have an effect, but aerosols are also produced by particulate emissions from automobiles, from coal-fired plants, and so on. So they're part of the equation. And there are other factors we don't understand fully. The El Nino and La Nina, complex oscillations of the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, and so on. I mean, the whole thing is so complex, chaotic, I would emphasize. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that has made the contrarians, given them, has helped them, they think, is that current climate models cannot be used yet to retrodict climate changes in the past. When we try to do that, given the models we have, we're still unable to do it. I think climate models have gotten better. I mean, let's face it, these are very smart people. Climate scientists are very, very bright, but it's not. They can't do it yet in any satisfactory way. So that's why the contrarians will say, "Look, why are you going to ask us to make these dramatic changes in how we're running the planet in terms of human economies based on climate models, in which we should not have a lot of confidence?" All right. Now, so here's my bottom line, though. This is how I think the best way to approach people with legitimate concerns about humanity's effect on the biosphere. I mean, I'm an environmentalist. I mean, I think we have to take these concerns seriously. So one way of doing it would be this. Where can contrarians agree with Greens? Where can modern contrarians agree? Look, we need to get cleaner fossil fuels. Whether it's clean coal or natural gas, nuclear power plants, that should be on the table. If Greens are not willing to do that, then I don't take them as seriously as I otherwise would, because nuclear power plants are produced vastly fewer casualties and have coal plants and coal production and the deaths people have suffered from breathing coal at particulate matter. Right. So, everyone should be on board decreasing our use of fossil fuels as much as possible, although it's going to take a long time to do that, and making them cleaner and finding alternative fuels sources. We need to find those big breakthroughs in solar. We need to find ways to store the energy that both solar and wind produce, the energy they produce. We can't really do that now. And we have to be more efficient. All of the above has to be put in place. So in other words, what I would say is we really more or less should be doing many of the things that Greens are calling for anyway, yeah. but for different reasons. I would say let's just bracket off the question of the human role in climate change, because we don't really understand it fully yet, and we don't know how much or how little it is. So the best possible outcome, of course, would be that climate science is pretty much wrong about this. In other words, a decoupling would occur between CO2 production and the increase of atmospheric or ocean temperatures. It's just not as significant as it was feared. Ocean sea level rise is not going to be as significant. Already the IPCC authors in many cases are saying that the sea level change is not going to be as dramatic as once feared, that probably the temperature rise will also be significantly less. I mean, there's growing realization that there's no linear relationship between CO2 rise and temperature increase, whether in land, atmosphere or ocean, so that their scientists are beginning to, because of this pause, rethink their modeling. And mm-hmm. they need to do that. Yeah. But in the meantime, moderns and Greens can agree on this, I think. We have to, for the long run, use our energy much more efficiently. We need to produce it in a way that has fewer environmental consequences, whatever they are. And we also have to pay attention to the needs, especially of those people who don't have any energy. And if we cannot factor them in, I mean, anybody who says, well, they just aren't going to get any, who is willing to just kind of consign them to lives of utter deprivation that would be unimaginable to us, I just can't take them seriously in the conversation. I mean, yeah. I totally get their point of view, though, because I used to hold a point of view something like that when I was a Green. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wrote papers and gave talks, which were not all that friendly to poor people.
Yeah.
I mean, I look back on those and I say, man, I needed to continue evolving.
Well, how would you see an integral view here versus a Green?
Well, I think the integral view would be that you have to take seriously modernist considerations about humanity. That, let's face it, human beings are anthropocentric. So we take our own interests more seriously than we do the interests of other life forms. And this was fine for a long time because we couldn't have much impact on the planet. Now, however, in the 20th century, 21st century, now that our impact on the planet and its biosphere can be pretty significant, although perhaps not as devastating as people fear, then we have to rethink how we're going to live on the planet. I mean, how do we live within a biosphere with other life forms, which we ought to respect and care about, and more people do, especially if they have enough money.
Yeah.
I mean, if you and I had no money, we'd be chopping those trees down and doing whatever we'd have to do to feed our families. I mean, that's just the way it would be. But our concern about the environment, I think, is something that Greens, environmentalists and Greens, have added to the modernist equation, and that the current clash you're seeing now is how to negotiate this, how to get that modernist concerns remain legitimate, that is, take care of humanity, even while trying to add to that, that we ought to be concerned about the biosphere mm-hmm. as well. How do you do both of those? Well, I think that modern countries, I mean, developed countries, as in Europe and North America, we've done a lot. It's much better environmentally here than it used to be. And that's because there was a general recognition, started with Nixon's presidency, amazingly enough. He signed the Clean Air and Water Act. He signed the Endangered Species Act. I mean, here was a Republican. I think it's something that Greens and environmentalists need to recognize. There was a time when environmental issues were perceived as a public health matter. In other words, the poison air and poison water and so on were intolerable if we could fix them and still have an economy, and we figured out we could do that. So that there was at one time environmentalism was embraced by Republicans. Not even recently, Newt Gingrich sat down with, I think it was Nancy Pelosi, for TV ads promoting global climate change action, you know, to prevent it. But now, of course, climate change has become so politically anathema for Republicans that you'll never see that. And this, I think, is a very unhappy situation. Because, you know, modernists need to be on board sufficiently on environmental programs, on environmental initiatives, sufficiently on board that at least they don't provide too much opposition. I don't know how exactly to put that. But now it's the situation has become that they're in Republicans, modernists, libertarians are increasingly anti-environmental.
Well, part of it, I think, is the success of the environmental movement, starting with Nixon, or at least him being a main player in that, is that a lot of it is gone. I remember growing up and not being able to swim in Lake Erie. I remember the cook ovens being let out in Youngstown, Ohio, when I had a basement apartment, and you could literally see the cloud of smoke coming into my. I'd have to get up and close the windows. I mean, this kind of thing. And now that's all gone.
Right.
And so, in some ways,
gone from here.
Yeah, gone from here. Exactly.
To China, right?
Exactly. But that happens as cultures develop into modernity and even postmodernity. And so, you even see this in places like China, where on the coasts, at least, you have the modern people living.
Right.
They don't want to choke in smoke and air pollution and bad water and all of this stuff. Now, in the center of the country, there's still a billion people who are trying to get out of subsistence. Yeah. So they're less concerned. They're not so world-centric.
Right.
But it seems to me that in some ways, the cure for the environmental degradation is continued development.
Yes, this is the this is the paradox which upsets sustainable development Greens. All right, because a growth economy, which produces wealth of the sort that allows people to take environmental problems seriously, is not a steady state.
Yeah,
it means bigger industry and more production and so on. And I would add to this, the other key component is the education of women. One reason that population growth drops as people become more wealthy is that women have more access to education. And as they do that, then their options change. They're beyond breeding other people, I mean,
right.
Which is a role women have been forced to play for a long time. And then they have more options. The populations drop. I mean, that's, if you study the history of economic development, as countries grow more wealthy, if population, the rate of increase drops significantly, dramatically. I was reading recently, I think it was last year or two, National Geographic had a big story about birth rates in Brazil. As people get wealthy enough to have TVs and so on, they discovered that not everyone, these women are not having 6-7 children.
Yeah.
They're having a completely different kind of life. They may have a kid or two, but it's not about
that. Well, in Mexico, it went from 7 women per children to 1.7 in about 20 years.
The same thing's going on in Brazil.
Yeah.
And so that part of it, it's hard to overestimate this. The change in the status of women can have such an enormous impact on environmental issues, because if you have fewer people, that itself right away is going to decrease environmental problems, because you have fewer people who need stuff. So, but that's a modernist enterprise.
Yes.
That's modernity.
Yes.
Empowerment, world-centric. Yeah, modernity started off leaving a lot of people out.
Yeah.
But the 19th and 20th centuries have been about various kind of liberation movements demanding that every human being get included. I mean, right now, the whole issue of gay rights and gay marriage and so on, these are late stage efforts to, hey, let's just get everybody inside the tent and just stop it. I mean, let's stop all this exclusion. There's no reason. We have to get over it. And so that shows the healthiness of modernity. That's its healthy side, its capacity to reform itself. Now, the downside has been environmental degradation and lack of concern about nature. That's where greens have been so important. But the greens, as has always happened to seemingly as a new stage goes on, vilify modernity, as I used to. I mean, I wish I could burn all those papers I wrote. They're out there. I used to be very critical of modernity. And regarded, you know, and I was totally green and was making all these people bad and wrong. And
well,
so
part
on.
Of it, I think, is just sort of built into our psyche, too. There's an apocalyptic stream in the human psyche that has always been there.
Yeah.
For most of human history, it was actually pretty accurate in the sense that your tribe was in an existential struggle with the other tribes and nations and so forth. And now that we're world-centric, it's like the apocalypse is global too.
Right.
But it's still, it's experienced in green religiously.
Yeah, that's what I've been seeing more and more commentary about that in the blogosphere the last couple of 3 years, including some fairly serious people who are maybe modernists, but also even green. There are significant high player greens who've switched on this.
Yeah, such as like Stuart Brand.
Well, Stuart Brand, he still thinks global warming is an issue and that humans are playing a significant role in it. But he has all these other points of view which are very critical of greens. He has a very, you know, he's one of these...
he's pro-nuke, for instance.
He's pro-nuke. And similarly, this guy Mark Linus, who wrote The God Species a couple of years ago, he's English. I've corresponded with him. And he was very green. But now he's taken a position which more or less, I guess it's more or less integral, although, again, he doesn't really know about that.
Yeah. That, you don't have to know about integral to be integral.
That's right. I think it's happening. That's part of the zeitgeist thing I think we're living through. But he's become very controversial because he would probably say a lot of the same things I'm saying right now, that if you're green, if you're serious about limiting fossil fuel use, then you got to go nuclear. Or at least you got to let it be part of the puzzle, part of the solution. If not, you're not really serious. Because you know democratic countries are not just going to go down economically and go back towards subsistence or something much different than what we have now in order to satisfy a group of scientists who say, well, in 50 or 60 or 100 years, it's going to be a lot warmer. I mean, who can think like that? It's not you're not going to be able to have a serious political.
But in the green religion, growth, modernity, and development is the evil. It's still organized around good and evil.
Right.
Psyche.
That's right. And that's what you and I talked recently about this as well. And that has to do with the changing role of science. When I was a green in the 70s, 80s, and into the early 90s, I and many of my other green colleagues, because I was involved in a lot of these formation of deep ecology and all this kind of science and technology were the devil. That's why we're in this mess. you know, air pollution, loss of species, you know, the whole thing, all the problems which we are concerned about. We said, look, it's all because of modern science and technology. Now, a really interesting thing happened in the early 90s. The Cold War had ended. The Cold War was carrying the apocalyptic load for a lot
of
people.
Yes, I know.
Especially modern.
I love that, carrying the apocalyptic load.
Right.
Because it's true.
Right. And especially for
modern. I go back to the fucking killer bees. I remember laying awake worrying about the killer bees.
Well, that's...
When I was whenever this was, the 70s.
Yeah, they're going to...
And then we've been through swine flu. Why Y2K cured me?
Yeah, I said, I mean, really? I mean, whatever happened to Y2K?
Nothing.
Nothing. But the point it would be, and it goes back to what you're talking about the green religion and the gloom and doom kind of catastrophe is coming, and we're going to be punished for our carbon footprint sins.
Yes.
You know, I think many analysts who are trying to look at this as a cultural phenomenon, kind of bracketing off whatever truth value it has, just observing the rhetoric, says, look, this is a classical religious movement. Gaia is going to punish us for our sins. We deserve it. We're a horrible species. It's chewing up the planet. We're selfish, arrogant. You know, the works. I totally get it. I've been there.
I do too.
Right. I mean, there's something to it. There's something to all that. I mean, there's something to it. But come on, it's not. It's an inadequate picture, and a lot of it is so driven by dissociation from modernity. And that we've got we're the good guys, they're the jerks, and we're now. This poses a big problem. I sent you that quotation from von Storch, a very famous German climate scientist who still thinks that the warming's happening, but he has to admit there's been this pause. But he says, "Look, let's face it. Scientists are very subjective in many cases." And the public doesn't understand the extent to which scientists are influenced by their own cultural situation and their own enthusiasm. So he's smart enough, to reflect upon his own enterprise and recognize the dangers in science posed by a confirmation bias.
It's amazing.
You know, he's one of those scientists who's willing to admit it.
Yeah.
And I totally know that. I mean, that's the nature of the human being. Scientists are not immune. What science relies upon is that some other scientists will be sufficiently skeptical of the claims they're making and start developing doubts about it and will make their reputation by refuting the taken for granted view.
Yeah. See, this is the cool thing about science is in any given moment, the zeitgeist may blow science and scientists one way or the other. But over time, just that scientific method, the desire for the next generation to debunk the previous generation, it all comes out in the wash.
Well, look at it. I completely agree with you about that. I've been thinking about this a lot, and because of the whole science thing, the issue of the political and cultural context of science. Think about who were the scientists in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, into the 80s, who were being so criticized by the Greens. These people came out of the Depression and World War II. They were total modernists.
Yes.
They didn't. They
build,
didn't
baby, any, build. Drill, baby, drill.
They didn't have any environmental. This wasn't part of their worldview.
Yeah.
Now, with scientists coming up in the 80s and 90s who are now environmentally conscious, including many climate scientists.
Yes.
Many climate scientists are green. Not all of them, but many of them are. That's a different worldview. So Greens are naturally going to be attracted to those scientists because they're right.
Yeah.
Whereas the other scientists were wrong. Well, it's not that simple.
Yeah.
I mean, so just doing a kind of cultural studies or epistemology of science modeling of what goes on in climate science reveals, you know, much more complicated, much more complex and nuanced understanding of science. I've been trying to come up with a way of phrasing this, and you and I have chatted about this. Imagine that the big science, you go back to the 50s and 60s and 70s, when big science was on the side of activities and practices which the fledgling environmentalists were against. Well, at that time, science was bad and wrong. Now, the last 15, 20 years when global warming has been so important, well, science is completely, it's irrefutable. These people are, you know, completely unaffected by emotional, cultural factors. They're like robots of rationality and so on. Well, it's just strange credulity, doesn't it? I mean, they have their own issues, as von Storch admitted in his interview with Der Spiegel. So it's not as if he just caved in and said, oh, well, we were wrong. He's not ready to do that. But he says another 4 or 5 years like this, all bets are off, basically.
Yeah.
But he said, in the meantime, the public needs to understand that we are human beings and we can be influenced by fads and ways of looking at things that we need. That's why the corrective nature of science is so important. If that fails, we're really in trouble. But if you study the literature, there's more and more peer-reviewed studies which call into deeply into question, for example, the idea that this is the warmest time in, you know, in the last whatever many thousands of years, because it looks like the medieval warming period was warmer than this. It looks like there was a Roman warming period warmer than this and so on. And these were not affected by human carbon dioxide production. These look like natural variability. And we've been recovering from the mini ice age starting in the mid-19th century. So the temperatures have been going up with kind of a wave action. We got to go up and they dip down for a while, then they go up again as they did. And then they go down like in the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s when we feared an ice age was coming. And now we've started to go up again the last 20 or 30 years. How much of that is driven by human activity? That's the big kahuna, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
No one really knows the answer to that.
Yeah.
We're not in a position to identify, oh, it's just the CO2. Can't say that.
Well, speaking of science and how it ultimately moves the ball, what do you think about geoengineering and some of these big projects that purport to, you know, or at least there's research or whatever being done on influencing the systems?
Yeah, that I know. I've been reading about that for the last 7 or 8 years when it started to come up and the as people became more and more concerned about, you know, maybe we're just going to make the planet too hot, you know. But I really worry about that. I mean, since we don't really understand the climate to begin with, how can we intervene in a way that will have the desired effect? How will we know that it will do that instead of creating a whole new, you know, a perturbation which will have consequences which we can't predict?
Well, I imagine we'll have some unintended consequences, but we work our way, you know,
right.
we do it by experimenting.
Right. Well, there are people who are willing and ready to do that. I mean, it could be done. I mean, we could add enough, and it would not be economically crippling, we could add enough particulate matter to the atmosphere on an annual basis to cool the planet a bit. I mean, to prevent the worst increases. But we don't know really how Gaia would react to that. You know, I was reading a New Scientist. They had an issue out a few weeks ago about revisiting Gaia, basically, and talking about the role forests play in climate regulation. The Gaia hypothesis, developed by Lovelock in 1970 and 72, I guess it was, says that life on the planet regulates its own conditions. So the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere, the temperature of the planet, the amount of the salts in the oceans. Think about that. Think about all that stuff that running into the ocean every year, topsoil and stuff. Why hasn't the pH and the acid nature of the oceans changed over thousands? Because it's being regulated. Somehow life is able to, now this is such a fabulous hypothesis, able to regulate its own conditions. That's the burden of his Lovelock's hypothesis, the Gaia hypothesis. And so what the New Scientist essay was talking about was the role of forests play. Well, one thing that's happened in the last 30 years, as NASA photographs have demonstrated, is the planet has greened considerably. Mm-hmm. The added CO2 has allowed for a lot of plant growth.
Now, what about the deforestation fears and so forth?
Well, obviously, that's something that needs to be addressed, if nothing else, for no other reason, that forests soak up a lot of CO2.
Well, have they? It's greened or it's deforested? Which one is it?
Well, for example, look at the east coast of the United States. In 1900, it was still pretty much deforested as a result of people in the 1800s still trying to farm there. Well, no one farms in the East Coast anymore because its soil's rocky. The whole East Coast is greened. All those forests are back. I mean, it's an incredible transformation.
No, it's funny. I was in Williamsburg, Virginia, visiting mm-hmm. the old town and so forth. And it's so beautiful. And it's yeah. so lovely with these big, beautiful trees. The truth is, during the time of when Williamsburg was built, there were no trees.
Yeah.
They were all cut down for firewood.
Right.
And people were freaked out over it, too.
Yeah. Well, they knew this couldn't be good.
Yeah.
But they had no coal. They had no...
No, this whole energy environmental thing goes back a long way. And the idea that even indigenous people lived in some harmony, they did. I mean, they often served as food for a predator. That's harmony. But we've always done everything we can to impact the environment to our benefit. Now, the fact is now we have tools that are, very consequential.
Well, but also tools and access to alternative fuels, which have made the situation better. I mean, as you're pointing out, remember back in Youngstown and Pittsburgh, I grew up in Akron, and I grew up not far from Youngstown, really, the incredible coal pollution and pollution from those coke plants and so on, producing iron. It was, and steel was horrible. But for one thing, a lot of that stuff's gone to other countries, which are suffering now because of inadequately regulated production and so on. But we've seen a tremendous improvement in North American and European environmental conditions because of developing technologies and new fuels and so on. I mean, so Matt Ridley, who's a very well-known economist and writer from England, has written a number of good books and has a lot of – he's kind of a sensitive modernist, okay? He understands the importance of environmental issues. But he's a serious modernist saying, look, why do we assume that things are going to get worse? I mean, in the past 300 or 400 years, things have definitely been improving for millions and billions of people. If you look at the graphs showing, for example, the decline of poverty, yes, we've had more poor people ever than ever. But as a percentage of the population, it keeps going down. In the past, 10 or 20 years, more than 1 billion people have been raised into something approaching middle class. Yeah. What an incredible achievement. Why can't we celebrate that? At the same time, recognizing that, look, we also got to keep working on allowing the others to come on up. How can we do it with the least environmental bad consequences? Yeah. Why can't those be working in tandem rather than having a more, of course, many Greens are willing to have this conversation. Yeah. It's not.
I think more and more are. Yeah, and I do think it's a move into integral because it is both. We want development. We're going to have people are going to develop. They're going to move into modernity. They should.
We can't stop them. Yeah. We shouldn't.
Yeah. Right? And at the same time, to get ever cleaner, ever more sustainable. All of that good stuff. At the same time, I have a feeling we'll muddle through.
That's what the conclusion I've been coming to. Somehow we're going to muddle through.
Yeah.
And ultimately, I think the future is going to be better and better.
Yeah.
I don't see why we. I used to think that. It's like you. I had that experience, about worrying about this and that, and I was convinced that by. I couldn't believe that 2000 came around and the planet was not a smoking cinder as a result, for example, just of nuclear war, which would have been the worst imaginable environmental catastrophe.
You could be forgiven for thinking that.
I mean,
when we saw what happened in World War II, we saw the atomic bombs go off, and then all of a sudden, the two superpowers have 3,000 each facing each other.
Which they don't really plan on using because what's the point of it?
Well, now they don't. But, in the 60s and 70s, that was very real fear.
Who knew, right? I mean, but the other thing, you mentioned World War II. And this is one of the things that Matt Ridley and others like him, I think economists, one of the things that environmentalists don't do enough of, and I'm guilty of this, I look back, we don't really understand economics. We don't really understand the nature of economic factors and markets and so on. For example, this rapid shift to natural gas. We don't get how signals in the marketplace transform things rapidly. But one of the things he would point out, you mentioned World War II. Well, think about World War II. It was just scarcely a bump in the road in terms of economic development.
Amazing.
100 million people dead, or however many horrible people were killed in these horrible circumstances. But by the 60s, I mean,
Japan and
10,
Germany,
15 years,
both
roaring,
the two losers.
Two losers. Too bad England
didn't
lose.
The two biggest, exactly.
We would have invested the Marshall Plan in them, and they would have been like Germany and Japan. Yeah. I mean, it's just... So, I mean, if World War II is simply a temporary, blip, right? Why not have confidence that humanity is going to muddle through this, and that a lot of things are going to get better, and there are going to be problems at the same time?
Yeah.
We're not going to enter the promised land.
How about, you see this on the green websites, this exponential thing, this hockey stick, where it's, you know, things just all of a sudden just explode out of control. And I don't know, is that...
Well,
the
hockey stick, the hockey stick thing has been largely debunked. I mean, that flat temperatures and then suddenly this rapid exponential rise. I mean, there's been pushback from geophysicists and so on. You claim, look, the samples they used were so few that, and moreover, you had the medieval and the Roman warming periods were at least as warm as they are now, probably warmer for a sustained period of time. So, and that wasn't CO2. So why do we are so upset about this? So there's all this discourse about tipping points. That's the term I see very often. Well, if we reach a certain point of CO2 or certain temperature, well, then the whole system will go out of control and we'll end up like Venus. I mean, the planet will be so hot that nothing can live on it. Is that a possibility? I don't really know. I don't
guess we can't rule it out.
It can't be totally ruled out, but is it, how credible is it? I mean, based on what? It's something that might happen. But sure, we could also be hit by a big meteor. That could happen.
Yeah.
So to what extent do we regulate our economies based upon what is probably a pretty very small thing that might go wrong? Why make that the way in which we're going to, the basis on which we're going to make our economic decisions?
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that Europeans are faced with now, especially England and Germany, as well as other places, is that they made a big bet on the global warming thing and started to remodel their energy production based upon, wind and solar and so on. And they have, those have, you know, significantly added to the fuel mix, but by cutting down, for example, England really cut back on coal production and stuff. Now everybody, the European power costs are really going up, and there's a deep rethinking economically of commitments they made. I mean, what are we doing here? No one else is doing this. And they also refuse to produce natural gas through this fracking method in a lot of cases, even though it's out there because of green considerations. They don't want to build nuclear power plants. In fact, Germany's committed to closing all of its, and what are they going to put in its place? Coal.
Really?
Yes. This is the downside of being anti-nuclear at a moment when you can't produce enough through air and solar to make up the difference. So what are you going to do? You have to start putting out more coal again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's really for the Greens there. It's got to be a tough nut to swallow. I mean, that's... Mm-hmm. But the point, I suppose, is this. Based upon modeling projections, Europeans... being really green. I mean, you might say that Germany is the greenest country in the world, probably.
Yeah.
And England and other countries really in the EU made a, based upon their green cultural worldview, made economic decisions about, or made, let's say, power production decisions about how to produce power, which are coming back to have a pretty negative effect economically. And now they're forced to rethink this. I mean, this is part of the big discourse in Germany and in England and Spain and elsewhere now. Did we make the right move mm-hmm. here? And how can we, what to do? Right?
Okay.
Because, I mean, let me, you know, I will say this. Look, no one really knows what's going on here. I mean, the reason I say that is because we're not standing in the year 2100 and looking back to see what happened. Were we there, we could say, yeah, that's the way it worked out. And this or that got confirmed or disconfirmed, but we're not in a position to say that. So what do we do in the meantime? Because we're in this messy situation. Well, that's where I go to the pragmatist line, and that would be, let's see what everybody agrees that we should be doing and do that at least. We got to take care of the people who are really poor, but that means they're going to need power. And how are we going to generate that? okay? And also, how can we continue to sustain our own economies because electricity is everything.
Yeah.
If you don't have electricity, that's it.
Yeah.
The end of the economy. How do we produce electricity in a way that's as environmentally responsible as it can be, while consistent with the economic growth that's needed to allow people to have a lifestyle that they demand?
Right.
I mean, and you can't, unless you're an eco-dictator, and there's plenty of Greens who would prefer the planet be run by eco-dictators. I totally get that. If we don't have that, then you have a much more difficult process involved, a messy democratic and debate and so on that will muddle us through probably.
Yeah.
But unrestrained modernity on the one hand versus unrestrained green on the other, neither of those are options I want to play with. If trying to work from an integral perspective, I want to recognize the value of both these views.
Yes.
And help create circumstances in which people from these cultural viewpoints can have a conversation for action that will lead to something that everyone can agree upon is a good thing.
Well, that is a very good goal, Michael.
Hey.
And that is, about as integral as it gets, is to be as friendly as we can to both of these perspectives and work to find common ground and move forward.
One of the things I've envisioned, and that is a series of workshops. Imagine a seminar when you bring in moderns and greens and traditionalists.
Yeah.
All right. And people who are willing to at least be in the conversation. You want people who are willing to undertake such a thing. And one of the things that each group would have to do, if you're a traditionalist, you would have to display as articulately as you can the value of modernity. Why is it so important? Why is what it's trying to do considered so valuable by so many people? Then do the same thing for green.
Yeah.
And then you Greens, you'd have to do the same thing for modernity and for traditionalists, because green doesn't like either one of those, especially if the traditionalists are coming from Europe and you're Christian and Jewish, and they have this, God is, the guy is not, creation is beneath God. It's, the whole thing. And then have modernists. Part of their work would be to represent why green is so valuable, why it can be considered even an advance in terms of evolutionary, and the same thing for traditionalists. Instead of dissociating themselves like the French revolutionists, modernity, the traditional views are horrible and we just got to get rid of the church and all this kind of stuff. So that would be a really interesting process.
It would.
To be forced to give the best, honest, and, it's so hard to do.
Yeah. What you're talking about is a sort of a bigger expression of couples therapy. It's just classic couples therapy.
I like that analogy.
Yeah, because in couples therapy, one of the classic things is to state your partner's point of view to their satisfaction.
To their satisfaction.
Yes.
That's right. And so the modernists would be sitting there saying, the Greens, you're not getting this.
Yeah.
You've gone a ways with this, but what about these three factors you're not taking seriously? And the same thing with the Greens to the modernists or the traditionalists. That's a really nice analogy. I really like that.
Well, I hope you pull that off. Let me know. I'll help you.
Okay.
All right, Michael, anything else we need to know here?
Well, we could go on for a few more days, but I think
we'll check back.
Touches on a lot of it.
The world will keep turning,
it'll
I suspect.
Keep turning, right. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Michael Zimmerman. Good topic, good discussion, and more to come.
Enjoyed it very much, as always, Jeff. Thank you.
See you next time.
Okay.